You are listening to the Tricorder Transmissions, episode 70. And
now,
here are
Craig
and
Jeff.
And welcome back to the Tricorder Transmissions. This is episode number 70. Let that be your last battlefield. We are your hosts, Jeff Hewlett.
And Craig Cohen.
Mr. Cohen, 70 episodes, our regular episodes. It's pretty crazy that we've come this far. And that's not even counting the supplementals or the What Are Little Songs Made Of series we're doing with 5-Year Missions. This is just 70 regular commentaries already.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. And it's also got me thinking now that we're fairly close to finishing the series.
Yeah, we're getting there. Not many left. I mean, you know, before the summertime hits, we'll be done with the series proper.
Yeah.
Moving on to other pastures, which we still haven't completely decided on. And, you know, it's still the number one question we seem to get out there is what are we doing after?
Well, we've committed to the animated series, right?
We have, but I know we've talked about, you know, where do we want to, do we want to go right into that? Do we want to cover some other stuff first? And we talked about doing a, you know, series of special episodes based on all the characters.
Yeah.
And things like that. So, you know, where do we go next? I think we still have a lot to talk about.
Yeah,
when
yeah.
it comes to that. So, you know, this episode, you know, Let That Be Your Last Battlefield is usually highly regarded for being, you know, an eye-opener, and it makes you think about stuff. And, you know, this episode, watching it back for our commentary, really made me think about you and me and why we've been disagreeing so much on these third-season episodes. And I think okay. I figured it out.
All right. I'd love to hear this.
So I think it's because I'm geek on the left and nerd on the right, and you're nerd on the left and geek on the right.
That might be it.
I think that's why we're clashing so much.
I think you figured it out.
Yeah, pat myself on the back there, and I just, you know, was sleeping on it last night and just kind of came to me before I fell asleep. But news-wise, not a heck of a lot going on this week, but there is a little teaser of a second series of those new Star Trek action figures that we talked about last week.
All right, cool.
Funko ones, and it looks like the second series of figures has some interesting additions to it. So you are going to get your Captain Kirk, who is not in the first series. Also, you get your Scotty, but two other characters are of interest. One is Vina, and, of course, the almighty favorite, the Gorn.
Okay.
So I think if I don't wind up buying the entire series, I'm at least going to attempt to get a Gorn.
Sure.
Yeah, he looks kind of cool. I mean, like I said, they're kind of that old school Star Wars figure feel, you know. So he's not as articulated as the Diamond Select Gorn figure, which I have as well, which is really incredibly cool. But still, any Gorn is good Gorn. I see there's also the possibility of them issuing what looks like Big Bang Theory figures.
Oh, wow.
In original Trek uniforms.
That's funny.
So I see a couple of them pictured there. There's a Sheldon and a Spock with the Spock ears, and there's Bernadette in a science officer uniform. So pretty interesting.
Yeah.
But I know Big Bang Theory does a lot of Star Trek stuff on the show, so that makes sense.
Yeah.
That might be about it for news. Do you have anything that you want to bring up before we move into our commentary?
No, I don't think so, man. I just really digging, chugging along on the series, really enjoying the work we've been doing with 5-Year Mission.
Oh, yeah.
It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it has been a lot of fun. And, you know, we're not completely out of it yet. So, you know, we got at least, what, 9 more episodes after this one. So, yeah, we'll be around a little bit longer. And
Well, yeah, and then it also just depends on if we're going to do the cage or not.
I think we came up with a special plan for the cage too. I think might be pretty cool. So.
Oh right, yeah.
Yeah, so we won't reveal what that special plan is yet, but I think we're gonna have an all-star cast for that one.
Yeah, but we could talk about the lost tricorder transmissions episode.
You want to talk about that now or save that for the cage?
I don't know. I guess we can save it. I think astute listeners might be able to figure out what that lost episode is.
Yeah, astute ones. I think some of the listeners that we talk to outside of the show, they kind of know the story behind that episode and what happened during the recording and how things went awry. So
yeah,
it's a fun story though. So maybe we'll use that as part of the intro for the cage, but. You ready to jump into Z commentary?
Yeah, let's go.
All right. So air dates. First air for this episode was January 10th of 1969. Remaster, strangely close, January 19th of 2008.
Oh, wow. Okay. And we have the NBC press release from December 20th, 1968. Frank Gorshin is guest star as Belly, one of two aliens who threaten to explode the Enterprise in their battle with each other, climaxing 50,000 years of hatred in Let That Be Your Last Battlefield on the NBC television network Star Trek Colorcast, Friday, January 10th.
That's a pretty cool press release.
Yeah.
I like the way that's written. It's very, very effective. So cue up your videos, everybody, and we will start our commentary in 3, 2, 1.
There we are. Again,
Craig. Familiar. Yes. 5730.2, Captain's Log. Interesting. So en route to... I love this beginning sequence here, and this Captain's Log is interesting to me because it kind of reveals some things about the Trek universe that you always wonder about. And, you know, they're going to a planet called, I think, Arianus is the name of it, but there's some sort of a disease or something. They have to decontaminate the planet, right? But one thing Kirk says that the planet is a transfer place, a popular transfer place for regular space commercial lines.
So okay, yeah.
There's like space UPS, you know? They're shipping stuff. You know, it's Amazon Prime in the Star Trek universe, and they can't get the packages through because the planet is contaminated, right? So you got to get out there and fix it. And another thing I thought was interesting about is Kirk mentions that the planet has a Ministry of Health.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you don't really hear a lot about these planets having forms of government and things like that. But I thought it was interesting that it would also have some form of a government that has, you know, different departments and things. I kind of like that. But at any rate, so stolen shuttlecraft flying around.
Yeah, that Sulu actually knows.
Yeah.
He says it looks like the one that was reported stolen a couple weeks ago, which I think is a really cool little detail for Sulu.
Yeah, and it makes it – Sulu keeps up with the news.
Yeah.
He pulls out his iPhone between button presses there and keeps up with his RSS feeds. You know, space CNN.
And I love the fact that we're getting Chekhov and Sulu at the at the control board.
Yeah, I mean, it seems so inconsistent. Chekhov's appearances – yeah. Seems so inconsistent in the third season. Like, he just kind of shows up and not. So here's a remastered effect of the shuttlecraft coming into the hangar. And I like the notion that we're seeing kind of a little bit about how the tractor beam works and that they can use the tractor beam not only to lock onto a ship or to pull it closer, but they can actually use it to guide a ship into the hangar, right, and land it.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool. So here's a nice shot of the Da Vinci. And it's rotating around. I thought that was kind of a neat thing they did with the remastered episodes to add those things in there.
Oh, totally.
And I think this is the last appearance of the hangar deck on this original series. So pretty neat. Pretty neat. See, you know one thing? Oh, and here's the big reveal. So we've got Lokai here who just fell over. And he's half white and half black. Literally half white and half black. So, I wonder, and I should have done the research on this, Craig, before we started talking about it, but, you know, this episode was aired in 1969, right? So I'm wondering, did the famous New York black and white cookie exist before this episode, or was it inspired by this episode?
Oh, I'd like to think it was inspired by this
episode. I would like to think so, too. I mean, maybe people not familiar with the New York black and white cookie maybe saw it on that famous Seinfeld episode where they played up the New York black and white cookie. But if you've never had one, God, you're missing out. Those things are great. Every time I go to New York City, I've got to get one. So they're good. That's the first thing I thought of when I saw, Lokai roll over like that. I was like, I want a black and white cookie now.
That's funny.
But at any rate. So
this was an episode we talked about earlier in the week where I had said that this one was really one I was looking forward to, because this was probably one of the episodes that I would consider, one of my favorites prior to us sitting down to start this show. And
interesting,
I hadn't watched it in probably a good 10 years. It was interesting sitting down and watching the show now. Or the episode now, after sort of being into what we're doing, and how my perspective has changed over the years.
Very cool. I'm looking forward to discussing this as we go further into the episode with you, because I think this episode in particular is usually regarded very highly as one of the highlights of the third season, right? And I'm not sure where I stand on it at this point, so I'm interested to kind of run through this whole thing.
Yeah. You almost have to wonder, though, if that regard is really attributed to the upcoming guest star we're going to see, Frank Gorshin.
Of course. Of course.
Because his performance is so high level.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. That ranks right up there with some of the best guest stars they've had on the series. So looking forward to seeing him jump onto the screen here. But I found this sequence quite interesting. When they have Lokai kind of sleeping there in sick bay. And there's a couple things about this sequence that I thought were really kind of eye openers. One is that Spock is unfamiliar with this alien species. So I always find it interesting that Spock doesn't know something, because usually he's familiar with everything. So when you have an alien show up that he has no idea about, and he's got to try to ask Dr. McCoy, is this skin tone, is this normal, or is this something, is he a mutant, or, I thought that was cool. And I also thought it was very interesting that Spock kind of calls out McCoy about the medicines that he's administering to Lokai without knowing anything about his physiology. I think, what does he call them, poison potions or something of that nature?
Yep.
And then McCoy kind of gives what I thought was a really good explanation as to how he's able to treat aliens that he's never encountered before. And he says, blood is blood, and he goes down some kind of standard things that he can try, even despite not knowing, how the body chemistry of these aliens work. I thought that was really fascinating.
Yeah.
So interesting stuff there. A little exposition, a little bit of, knowledge about things you may have been scratching your head about. And I know, especially like in Star Trek VI, right, that there's that scene where, McCoy is jumping up on a table to try to, jumpstart a Klingon heart, right? And he's talking about how he doesn't know the Klingon anatomy that well. And
right.
And you always wonder about doctors and how they're able to improvise on the go. And I like to hear a little bit of the background behind that. So another interesting thing, while I'm on this topic of interesting things, I love that Lokai has heard of the Enterprise.
Yeah, wow, yeah.
He's like, I've heard of the Enterprise, yeah. So the word of Captain Kirk and his ship has spread to alien races who they've never encountered before. So pretty cool. Pretty cool. But he stole the shuttlecraft, right, from Starbase 4. So that leads us to believe that he somehow was able to get to Starbase 4 and get into Starbase 4 and into the hangar to be able to steal a shuttlecraft. So obviously he's encountered some humans before. Maybe some of them told him about the Enterprise.
Right, yeah. And I guess he was hoping that somebody would eventually find him.
Yeah, I guess so. It seems like, at the setup for this is, Lokai is, persecuted revolutionary and he's, trying to drum up support and find asylum so that he can't be captured. By his pursuer. So it stands to reason, I guess he was, encountering different alien races, and I guess Starbase 4 was just some place he happened to turn up to try to find some help, some sanctuary. And I guess his pursuer must have also arrived at Starbase 4 at some point, and maybe he stole the shuttle to get away from him from there, and then the chase continued. So I love Kirk's nature here, where, you know, he's treating the guy as a criminal and kind of, you know, not really buying into what he's trying to sell yet. So another alien ship, by the way. So we're about to get our little tent scene here on the bridge, which I really enjoy this invisible ship sequence. But this was pretty cool. And Shatner also seemed to know where Lokai's planet was. So he seemed to know it was in an uncharted part of the galaxy. It was right. Like the southern part, I think he said. But if it's uncharted, I'm surprised he would know where it was. But interesting.
Well, the more surprising thing is that there's actually an uncharted section of it.
Yeah, really.
Of the galaxy, considering how much of it's been charted during the course of this series, places that they've gone that have already been visited.
Yeah, really. And did you catch, there's the name drop. He name drops the Romulans there. I love that he asks if the invisible ship is a Romulan vessel with a cloaking device.
Right.
So a little bit of continuity thrown in there. Pretty cool. I like that. And the Spock is able to, even though they can't see it, Spock is able to tell them that the ship has no weapons and is built for speed. So a little information about the capabilities of the Enterprise scanning equipment, I suppose. So no weaponry, nothing identifiable. Interesting. But yeah. This is also an effect of the budget cuts, by the way.
Yeah.
Why the ship is invisible.
Yeah. Well, another thing that I picked up reading through the These Are the Voyages section on this episode in the book is half of the actor budget for this episode was used for Frank Gorshin.
Wow.
So that's why you might not see as many crew members in the hallways and whatnot. And after reading it, I retroactively went back in my head and thought about the episode, and I was like, wow, yeah, the corridors do seem a little empty.
Yeah, especially during the sequences where they're running near the end of the episode and they're running through all these corridors and you get these tracking shots behind them as they're running. There's not a single crew member to be seen.
Yeah.
So this is there's that effect, that camera zooming effect on the red alert beacons that you see. I think it's only this episode that has them, right? And it's kind of jarring to me to see that. And they use it a couple of times in this episode where whenever Kirk signals a red alert, you see the beacon on the wall and the camera does this weird zoom in and out really quickly effect. So from what I had read, it may have been a nod to the Batman TV series.
Okay.
And the fact that you know, we have the Riddler coming on here in Star Trek. So I don't know if that's true. Was there anything about that in These Are the Voyages that you remember reading?
No.
And there he is. There he is. So interesting entrance. So this ship that he was, this invisible ship that he was flying on, you know, was on a collision course for the Enterprise. And it disintegrated, and he was able to somehow beam himself directly onto the bridge of the Enterprise. That's amazing.
Yes.
And it's Belle of the planet Charon. And quite calm for an alien, right? I mean, usually aliens that appear on the bridge are typically kind of hostile.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's pleading his case. So this episode is interesting to me in this aspect as well, that you have these two alien guys and you kind of have to make up your own mind, because they never really tell you which one is right and which one is wrong, or, you know, you have to try to pick which one you believe in your own mind. And it's interesting. I'd love to have a conversation on Facebook with some of our listeners about, you know, who they felt, you know, more sympathy for, or who they felt – they would side with if they were Captain Kirk or the Enterprise crew on this episode. I'm not sure where you stand on it, and I'm not even sure where I stand on it.
Yeah, you know what? Really, I probably lean more towards Lokai.
Mm.
But I think really the ultimate message of the episode is it might not really matter.
Mm.
It might be more that they're letting this physical difference between them really control the way that they feel about each other.
Yeah.
I agree. Could really be at the root of all the problems they have.
True. True indeed. So it's kind of a head scratcher, but you know, supposedly Belle and Lokai have been chasing each other around for 50,000 Earth years. That's a long time.
Yeah.
That's a long time. So are we meant to believe that they're immortal as well?
You would think so, because they're in their physical prime.
Hmm. So that's part of the head scratcher for me, is that you would think if you were an immortal race and you were around for that long, it's so weird that things like this would matter. Yeah. You know what I mean? You think you'd have all this time to do whatever you want with and you know, not be afraid of dying. So why would they, I don't know why they would be so divided. You think they'd be a little more enlightened.
Right.
You know, that they don't necessarily have the stress of other races who have shorter lifespans, you know, where they're worried about accomplishing things or, you know, acquiring, you know, riches while they have the time to enjoy them, things like that, that usually, you know, make people a little more hostile and hate-filled. But, so we're getting a little bit of background information that Lokai was a lowborn race, or considered to be a lowborn race that was enslaved or put into some sort of indentured servitude to Belle's class, which is the aristocracy, the upper class,
right,
of their planet. And it sounds like they were kind of in the middle of a societal shift where they were starting to allow the indentured people to be free and have their own communities. So, and that was 50,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So, but we're seeing the hatred start coming out here of Belle. And we're starting to see that maybe Belle is not the calm guy that we originally thought he might be. And the you know, the policeman or the, you know, the FBI agent who's just after this criminal that he's trying to catch. There seems to be a little more personal vendetta here as well. So I wonder if Lokai may have been in servitude to Belle.
Oh.
I don't think they really addressed that, but I wonder if he was one of his slaves. So, because there does seem to be a very personal attachment here, and they say that Lokai killed a bunch of people, or thousands of people, in trying to start a revolution to free the enslaved people, or you know, fight for their rights. So we've got an interesting juxtaposition between the two of them, but also a very deep-seated personal hatred for each other.
Yeah.
So interesting. So now we're getting the age old, listen, Kirk, you got to take me back to my planet spiel that many aliens have done. And once again, another alien force will take control of the Enterprise.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see Kirk's reaction here versus some of the other alien races that were able to, take control of things. And here you've really just stripped away any of that fatherly kind of tone that he might use. And this is just straight up stern, authoritative,
Yep.
I'm the captain type of delivery from Kirk. And it's really interesting to see how he modifies that based on who he's dealing with.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, whereas we see him, you know, in Alon of Troyes being the father figure in Whom Gods Destroy, we see him, utilizing his calm, almost James Bond like capabilities to get out of a situation. And now he's got to stand up and be firm with these two guys. And I really like that he cites that, he's all about the due process. You know, he's not just going to turn this guy over because you say he committed a crime. We don't know that. He's got to stand trial for what he did, for stealing the shuttlecraft. And one of the lines that I thought was really neat was when he was talking to Belay about, you know, you're aboard the Enterprise and that means you're bound by its regulations.
Right.
You may be a diplomat in your own world, but that doesn't mean you can do whatever you want on my ship. So he's changing his posture, you know, based on who he's dealing with, like you said. It's really cool stuff. And also, we also find out that Starfleet, although they have knowledge of the planet Charon, there are no official signed documents, no treaties or anything of the kind. They're not part of Starfleet, so there is no extradition capability. So Kirk is not bound by any Starfleet regulations to extradite the prisoner. So he's doing what he's supposed to do and taking him back to the starbase for trial, if you will.
Right.
So pretty cool little bits of background information about Starfleet regulations and interplanetary. Nice look at the engineering board there, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's kind of cool. I like you can see the lights changing. The little details like that where all the little lights kind of blink on and off and change. It's pretty neat. So we're used to seeing in our own lives, we're used to seeing, you know, computer screens with that kind of information on it. So neat that you see back then they had a manual looking, analog board with some lights on it. So interesting stuff. So, oh, by the way, the guest quarters are on deck six.
All right.
Found out. So pretty neat. So at any rate.
Yeah. So the creative team on this episode are all guys we've seen before. Director Judd Taylor, we saw on Wink of an Eye, and he'll next pop up directing The Mark of Gideon and finally The Cloudminders. Writer Oliver Crawford, who died in 2008 at the age of 91, is interesting in the sense that he had been affected by the big blacklist in Hollywood in the 50s for refusing to name communist sympathizers who was suspected, and he eventually worked his way back into Hollywood, and he wrote the Galileo 7, which we talked about way back, and he's got a story credit on the Cloudminders. And in addition to Star Trek, he wrote multiple episodes of Ben Casey, Rawhide, The Fugitive, among many others.
Huh. That's a pretty good history. Pretty good history. So
yeah,
questions.
Go ahead. Yes. No, I was going to say the whole blacklist thing, it just fascinates me.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. So question for you.
Yes.
Did you notice that sick bay is not secured?
Yeah.
He could just get out of bed and run out the door. Oh, I love it. He knows how to get to the bridge too. So we are now seeing that they have some sort of power, some sort of mental power. And Belay is taking control of the Enterprise and has put them on a course back to their home planet of Charon, where he's going to put poor Lokai up for trial. But, you know, we've established already that they've been pursuing each other for 50,000 years, right?
Yeah.
So my question for you is, if they've been chasing each other that long, why are they still so close to that planet? Wouldn't you think they'd be universes away from Charon by now? Why would Lokai hang around so close?
Yeah.
To Charon, right?
But and really, 50,000 years, that's like
unfathomable amount of time. Unfathomable amount of time.
I mean, their clothes are so clean.
Yeah. They must have laundry somewhere. Maybe they're dry clean only. Now, here's a cool effect. So these two are impervious to phasers. They have some sort of personal shield. But yes. It doesn't look like they have any devices on them.
No.
that would emanate these shields. So I wonder, is that an evolutionary thing? Is it something that their mental powers provide them the capability to do with some sort of a shield? And of course, it's the age old way to disable the Trek technology. So, you know, to build the tension. So if the phasers had actually worked, this would be a much easier and shorter episode.
Yeah.
You're like, okay, stun them both. Boom, boom, done. So, and, you know, now, of course, Kirk, because the technology doesn't work, he's going to have to use his mental powers, his skill at negotiating and talking his way out of stuff to get control of the ship back. So it's a pretty cool exercise for Kirk. I mean, we've seen him do this kind of stuff before, but I always enjoy seeing him figure out a way to get out of a situation without the use of phasers and brute force.
Right.
Right. So beautiful, tight shot of Kirk's face as he's threatening to destroy the Enterprise.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we get the introduction of the destruct sequence coming up here that they wind up reusing in one of the Star Trek movies. I think Star Trek 3, right?
I believe so, yeah.
I think it's Star Trek 3, and they repeat the destruct sequence pretty much word for word, just with different people doing it. But very cool shot of the computer's blinking lights there. We don't get a lot of close-ups of those either.
No, not at all. Yeah. And there's a couple of interesting shots in this episode. There's another one where we see Uhura's hands on the controls.
Hmm.
And even towards the end of the episode when Loki and Belli beam down, the angle that we see that from in the transporter room is an angle I don't remember ever seeing.
Yeah, it's like from behind.
Yeah.
And we're seeing the transport control panel from the opposite angle, which we usually see it, you know, from the front of it.
Yeah.
So pretty cool.
Yeah. This is a really important sequence in the sense that here is Kirk basically deciding that they're all going to go down with the ship instead of, you know, having the ship taken from them.
I find this very strange that he would make such a decision so quickly. You know, the Enterprise has been under alien control. These tight close-ups of the actor's eyes are an interesting choice as well. We don't really see this a lot.
Yeah.
But I think this is a very almost un-Kirk-like thing to do so early on in an alien takeover. I mean, we've seen them getting taken over before, but they don't immediately jump to, blowing up the ship. You would think that would be the absolute last resort. I mean, really, the only thing that this guy is doing is taking the ship to the planet. He's not threatening the crew at all. He's not putting the ship in any real danger. This is just Kirk, you know, not being in control of the ship and being kind of frustrated by that. So he's like, you know what? I'm just going to blow it up to hell with it. I'm going to kill all 430 crewmen and you guys just because I don't want to go to Charon.
Yeah. So, it might have been his read on the situation.
Yeah. I think maybe it was just a bluff all along, though. Maybe he figured, you know, Belli would succumb if he thought he had no other alternative.
Yeah, but, I mean, he doesn't show any sign of executing any kind of order prior to that lockout 5 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I guess that lockout, that's just really a mechanism for giving, you know, Loki Belli that last couple of split seconds to make a decision, and Kirk having enough time to say stop the sequence.
Yeah,
because 5 seconds is not a long time, but I guess that lockout means that, you know, that there's not enough time to disable it. The computer can't act fast enough, or I don't know. It's weird. 5 seconds.
Yeah, but I'm really also, you know, intrigued by the way the crew is reacting to this on the bridge.
Yeah, nobody seems panicked at all. Everyone's perfectly calm.
Yeah, well, I think it's one of those things where it shows their complete and utter belief in the captain.
I guess so.
I
mean, you would think at least one of them would stand up and go, wait a minute, whoa, let me get in a shuttlecraft first.
Yeah. And what do you think's going on the rest of the ship during this?
I don't know if the rest of the ship's aware. I mean, is the countdown audible throughout the entire ship?
I don't know. Do you think that's fair that, you know, somebody could be seemingly about to have their final moments and they're not able to say or do any of the things they might want to do in those final moments?
Yeah, really.
Everybody here on the bridge knows that, so they can say whatever kind of internal things they want to say with themselves, or but somebody could just be walking down one of those corridors and then boom, next thing they know, the ship blows up.
Or they're in the bathroom. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
You're in the bathroom stall and you're listening to this destruct countdown going, oh man, I'm not going to finish before the ship blows up.
Oh man, I'm
going
to.
What a way to go. But anyways, more really cool remastered shots of the ship flying in this one. I really enjoy the what they've done with the ship curving and swerving around and the star fields moving. It's adds a little bit of cool factor to the show, I think. Because, you know, this is another one of those bottle episodes where we don't get off the ship. So we see quite a few of those in the third series. Did you notice during the destruct sequence, they had that sound of like a teletype machine or something rolling through the whole thing? I wonder what that's about. Why would the self-destruct sequence have that sort of special sound effect tied to it? You know, I mean, I understand it's an audible cue for the audience to know what's going on, but I'm wondering, I mean, from a programmatic standpoint, whoever made those computers, Dr. Daystrom or whoever, why would he program that noise in as opposed to like a sequence of beeps or something?
Yeah.
Or almost the red alert sound. You know, you would think the red alert sound would be a great way to let everybody on the ship know something's wrong and not like a teletype noise. But
right, right.
Yeah. But anyway. So Kirk still refuses to lock them up. He's going to let them roam the entire ship, which is another questionable decision. I mean, do you think you'd let these two guys roam around the corridors of the ship after knowing that, one, they can take control of the ship, and two, that they're violently hateful of each other?
Yeah, I would have bring them up.
Yeah, I would have done it too. Well, that begs the question. Do you think they could have put them in the brig? They can't shoot them with phasers. You think they would have allowed themselves to be put into the brig? Maybe Kirk knows that.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, if you, they obviously, you have no way of physically forcing them to do anything. So they would have to go willingly.
Right.
But you know, I find it interesting that Kirk would allow them just to free roam the ship. I mean, it only stands to reason that Belle would find some other way to circumvent Kirk's only ace in the hole, which is that self-destruct sequence. Yeah. But, I mean, how easy is it to defeat the self-destruct sequence now that he knows how they activate it? I mean, all he has to do is kind of take out, you know, one or two of the people who have to put the codes in, and that would be it.
Well, that's seemingly what he does, though. He disables
the
mechanics of it.
He does. I mean, I think it would be even easier to do it, though, if you just kind of locked.
Just, like, knock Scotty out?
Yeah. Yeah. They'll take Kirk and Scotty out. Why not? You know? If you got those kind of powers. So this is an interesting sequence as well. I keep saying interesting.
It's like the eavesdroppings.
Yeah. I love that. This is one of the things that should have tipped Kirk off to, you know, the fact that he should have locked these guys down. Now, you've got Lokai sort of pleading his case to some of the Enterprise crew, and they seem to be sympathetic. You know, you got Chekov in there, and you got Sulu in there, and they're kind of reacting to what Lokai is saying. And, you know, it's very, very dangerous, I think, to allow this guy, especially Lokai, to walk around the ship and, you know, convert your crew members to be on his side. I'm not sure if I would have made the same decision, but I think Kirk seemed to state that he felt allowing them to experience the best of humanity on the Enterprise would help to make them realize that their hate is pointless. because humans are now so far beyond hate, right? So I wonder if... still don't think that was the best decision in the world. But, interesting that we get some confirmation from Sulu that Earth no longer has any sort of oppression, and that was kind of confined to the 20th century. That ended in the 20th century. So in our time today, we're still going to be experiencing the tail end of that, I guess. And by the time we get to Star Trek times, there will be no more of that.
Right.
So more drinking.
Yeah.
More drinking.
So Frank Gorshin, we mentioned, coming off of Batman, as the Riddler, and I didn't know this until sitting down for this episode. He won an Emmy for that role.
Did he really? I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
Huh. I'll have to go back and watch some of those old Batman episodes with the Riddler in them. I watch them when I see them pop up on IFC on TV when they do little marathons, but I haven't seen a Riddler episode in a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know the DVDs and Blu-rays just came out.
So yeah, they got pretty much the loving care that Star Trek got in terms of at least restoring the image. There was no retroactive effects work done, and that wasn't really an effects intensive show to begin with. But I did see some comparisons between what the show looked like when it was in syndication and what the DVD and Blu-ray restoration looks like, and it's pretty impressive.
So yeah,
I think you've even seen it on IFC. They're using the new restored prints.
Yeah, they do look really, really good. They look a lot like these restored Star Trek episodes. So
yeah,
you know, if you're a fan of that series, I think you're in for a real treat. Just as we were in for a treat when these episodes came out. But so now we're finally getting to it. We're getting to the reason why, there's that divide between Bele and Lokai's people, even though they seem to look the same. And I wonder if prior to this scene, I guess, and people who watched this episode when it originally aired, I wonder if prior to this actual talking out of the black on the left, white on the right versus the opposite, I wonder if people even really noticed that they were the opposite. Because if you really weren't paying close attention to the two of them when they were standing together, you might not even notice that the colorations on their faces were different.
Right.
So here's the reveal as Spock is questioning their physical makeup, and I love that Bele just, they have two different ways of looking at things. Kirk and Spock just don't get it at all. But to Bele, it seems like so obvious that they're two completely different, you know, people because of the colorations being the opposite on their faces. So, and here is, I think, the big reveal of this sequence, not necessarily the black and white thing, but we're hearing about the history of Vulcan, and Spock is kind of running down Vulcan's past and how they were only saved by returning to turning to a life of logic, and it saved his planet from extinction because they were hateful people, and they were warring with each other, and turning to logic actually made Vulcan survive, which I thought was a really cool reveal.
Yeah.
So, and we know that's talked about a lot moving forward into the Trek movies and things, and we hear all about the history of Vulcan, but I love that they throw those little bits in there, for the viewers to kind of get a little bit more backstory on what happened prior to the time that they're actually seeing.
Yes.
But, and also I love that Bele seems to know that the theory of evolution on Earth states that man evolved from ape-like descendants, right? So
right,
calls it. So they believe they're descended from apes, and the way he says it, apes, And now we're running down the theory of evolution here. You know, Spock kind of lays down the, and then that kind of ends the conversation. So there's a couple of things that Star Trek, once again, controversial things back then that Star Trek pulls into the television series here and kind of tries to provide its commentary on or give its perspective on.
Yeah, yeah. And speaking in terms of deliveries, this is the episode where we get the, I guess, really odd Kirk delivery of sabotage.
Yeah, it's coming up. And Scotty says, let her rip. I like that, too. Scotty says, go ahead, let her rip. So a little bit of slang kind of still alive in Star Trek times, things that we say today. Yeah. So I think we're going to this is kind of weird to me. I mean, this is a remastered effect, but they're supposedly decontaminating the planet. And there's a little thing hanging off the bottom of the hull of the ship that is supposed to be the thing that's decontaminating the planet.
Yeah, that's a lot of work, though.
Yeah, really. I wonder, I had thought maybe it would be spraying something into the atmosphere, but it, I don't know exactly what they're doing.
Yeah, it's probably like negative ions or something.
Yeah. Hmm. And now they see, the first time they didn't have to press that red switch. Now they have to press the red switch again. So
there's different steps probably.
I guess so.
I'd hate to see the instructions for it.
Hmm. Well, at least we get to know what some more of those buttons do on the console. Oh, could you imagine if Scotty accidentally pressed the jettison pod button? His finger was really close to it.
They would have gotten another episode out of it.
Yeah, I think it's the third button down. Yeah, who would he have killed that time? Yeah. I love that overhead shot right there. That's so cool. There's some interesting camera stuff that goes on in this episode. And we typically don't see overhead shots like that in rooms, right? And
yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and especially this far into the series, we're seeing spaces utilized differently than they had been.
Hmm.
Even a shot like this.
Yeah, where everybody's kind of what's Uhura doing there? She's not in her chair. She's kind of hanging out there, pressing some other buttons. And Chekhov is using Spock's equipment, which is typically Spock's station. So, and the computer's memory banks are burned out. I love how they zoom into Frank Gorsham right there. That was great. Kind of the camera almost parts the actors and kind of zooms right into. This is a little negative effect going on there. And this is another weird shot. So the camera work in this episode is so different. So we're getting a panning of the faces of all of these, all of the bridge crew who are standing there just watching.
Yeah.
Belly electrocute the computers.
Yeah.
But nobody tries to stop them. You know, usually, and that's another weird thing is that, you know, usually when something like that happens, even if Kirk knows that, you know, grabbing a hold of the guy is not going to work, he still tries it. Or Spock still tries it. Somebody would have grabbed him and tried to pull him away and stop him from doing that, right?
Yeah.
But nobody, they just kind of just hung out there. Hey, there's one extra guy in the background there.
Yeah.
A security dude. Yeah.
So this is Loci is Lou Antonio, born 1934, and we're going to talk about him on the podcast Zilch, the monkey show we do.
Oh,
when we get to the episode Hillbilly Honeymoon.
Ah, yeah, I remember that one.
Yeah.
That's the one where Davey's supposed to get married to the girl and they won't let him leave, right?
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure.
And then after his acting career, he spun off into directing, and most recently he directed William Shatner on Boston Legal.
Get out.
Yeah.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that must have been a very interesting couple of days on set together, you know, separated by 40-some-odd years.
Huh. Very interesting. I love when stuff like that happens. Did you catch that insult that Belly just threw out? He called humans monocolored trash. Unbelievable. I don't know if I should be insulted by that. And here again, Kirk is using the only instrument he has, his words.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is really the part of the episode that I think some people could consider a little too heavy-handed or a little too on the nose.
Yeah, this it is a little bit heavy-handed, but I I kind of focused in on the quality of the acting.
Oh yeah.
In this sequence, everyone does a great, great, great job delivering their dialogue in a convincing way. You know, I love, you know, Shatner's passion when he's trying to convince them to stop fighting, and he calms down, but you can see the nervousness in his face, and you can see the hatred from Lokai as he's kind of trying to plead for himself, and you see the frustration on Belly's face there as well. Everybody, and the physical acting as well, the hunching of the shoulders, and you know, Belly with his hands behind his back, and it's all so well done. And it speaks a lot to the direction of this episode as well. So excellent stuff.
Agreed.
So we've got the ship back in Kirk's control again. So lost control, regained control. Lost control, regained control. So now he's back, and they're within scanning range of the planet Charon. And here we get the unexpected twist. And kind of a sad twist, I think.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, everyone's dead.
Yeah, that's a shame. But yeah, we did get the sabotage moment in there too. I think we missed it as it went by.
And they're both having a hard time really processing the idea that everyone is gone.
Yeah, no sapient life forms registering at all, according to Mr. Spock. I love that remastered burning planet effect.
Yeah. It's a great, great visual.
Yeah, it almost looks like it's about to blow up or something.
Yes.
You know, really, really well done. I know I broken record with these remastered effects, but so tastefully done, and it doesn't take you out of the episode at all. It just adds something extra to it. You know, I love it. And great, great performance here by Frank Gorsham, too.
Yeah.
Realizing everyone's dead.
Yeah, and you're going to see their sadness turn into anger.
Yeah. And here it turns into anger and frustration and more fighting.
Yeah.
Genocidal maniacs did this. Yeah.
Just watching Gorshin's arms and hands there prior to thrusting out at Lokai is really some great physical acting.
Agreed. Totally. And here's Shatner stepping it up as well.
Yeah. He just can't understand at this point.
No, he's like, you've got nothing left to fight about, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But these are the moments I really love Shatner in the series. Mm-hmm. I really love when he delivers these really impassioned speeches. So great to watch. And his physical acting during those scenes is always so good, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, are there multiple turbo lifts?
I don't think so. But it's just the one that goes up the shaft to the...
Yeah.
To the bridge. And it, you know, goes on an angle and then kind of goes up and down through the hull, right?
Yeah, because Lokai went onto it. And then Belli went to go onto it, and the doors opened, and it was there.
Hmm. I wonder if it's really just that fast. Well, you know, I guess that would kind of call into question the need for a turbo lift at all. Why wouldn't they just transport between floors?
Yeah.
You know, they could just have little mini transporters all over the place and just beam between the floors.
Oh.
Oh, that poor guy got body checked, man.
He got rocked. I love the intercutting of the sort of burned out city.
Yeah, it's World War II footage.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, World War II footage they overlay in. Yeah, I love that their sadness makes them run like pansies. and you know, Gorsham's even like, look at that. I mean, come on, dude. I mean, you know, come on. That's a little hammy. You know, like... Did you pick up on that?
Yeah, yeah. That was one of my bigger memories from this episode was that visual.
I love that Spock is tracking them and giving them a play-by-play of where they're at. They're running by Recreation Room 3, and they're passing the Crewman's Lounge, coming up to Starbucks. This is great.
This ending is really sort of... I think it's the only ending they could have done.
Yeah, I think
but
so.
It's still pretty anticlimactic.
Yeah, I agree. I like it, but I would like a little more of a... I think he's channeling the Riddler there, by the way, with that run. I would like a little more of a resolution, but I guess this is one of those ones where they leave you thinking.
Yeah, it was the message they wanted to deliver really was the most important thing.
Mm.
And here's that transporter shot. Where I don't think we've ever seen it from that angle
before.
No,
I don't think we have.
And again, we have an unmanned transporter room, which to me just seems so not right.
I agree.
Shouldn't there always be somebody on duty there?
I would think there should always be at least a guard there. You know, that's a serious piece of technology. Not only unauthorized use, but sabotage. Sabotage.
Yeah.
So here's some of those great hallway shots, those tracking shots. I love those. Pretty cool. You get to see them, you know, people running through the hallways and a lack of crew members roaming around, as you said. Usually we see so many of them. But supposedly, I haven't actually read this, but there supposedly is a book, a Star Trek book. I believe it might be in the Voyager era, where they actually revisit the planet of Sharon in the future, and they it's said that Belle and Lokai are still alive, and they've kind of set up bases for themselves on the opposite sides of the planet and are still at war. So I have to look up what the title of that book is. I think some of our audience may know.
Yeah,
out there, or Chris Ritzer, our resident literature expert, he may know as well. So I'm sure it's out there on the internet somewhere. But so they've both beamed down to the planet. They both knew how to use the transporter too, by the way. So yeah. I wonder if they actually read some of the manuals, all the other aliens seem to do.
I know it bothers both of us though, that automatic transporter. You know, like, what is a person ever needed there for?
Yeah. That's true.
If you can put it into autopilot.
It's a good question. There's a lot of things
in the
show that you can nitpick but at any rate, I guess we are at the end of the episode, and would you like to give your essential voting first?
Yeah. I'm going to say that this episode, I don't hold it in as high regard as I did in my earlier days. But I still think that this is an essential episode. If you get beyond any of the character moments, which I think there are a lot of great character moments, just the presentation of the process and the means to destroy the Enterprise make this essential for me.
Yep. I've had a hard time with this one. Like, I think I said that earlier in our commentary, and I was hoping that your essential vote would kind of push me one way or another, but I'm still having a bit of an issue with it. But from my own perspective on what makes an episode essential, I think since the self-destruct sequence is actually reused verbatim in Star Trek III, I think the introduction of that concept is a good one. And I mean, you have a couple of other little things like Spock giving a little bit of Vulcan history. How Vulcan was, you know, near destruction and they were saved by logic. I like that explanation. And some of the medical stuff from McCoy, getting to understand a little bit about how he's able to work on aliens who he's had no experience with and have some sort of success in treating their ills is interesting as well. So I think I'm going to go 51-49 on the essential side.
Still on this counts. Episode,
but it's a hair. It's by a hair. And I may be, maybe some of our listeners who weigh in can sway me further in one direction or push me in the other for our season 3 wrap up happening in a few months. But that's that about wraps it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else from you, Craig, before we sign off?
No, just make sure to hit us up on all of the different memes that you can find us over on Twitter at TTT_pod. Our website, The Tricorder Transmissions, or over on Facebook as The Tricorder Transmissions.
All right. So that is the end of the episode. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And don't forget, coming up this Wednesday is another episode of What Are Little Songs Made Of? So keep your eyes out for that, and we will see you very soon.
Closing out this volume of Star Trek is the episode Let That Be Your Last Battlefield. The story was supplied by Gene Kuhn using the pseudonym Lee Cronin and worked into a script by Oliver Crawford. It dealt with racism directly, There was so much concern about civil rights and the way blacks were treated by some whites that this episode presented a race of people who were pigmented black on one side of their face, white on the other. Ludicrously, the two individuals in the story hate each other because they happen to be white on opposite sides. Oliver Crawford says that he wanted to hammer home the point that color is only skin deep. It is a show of which producer Fred Freiberger is very proud.